Chapter 37. Mrs. Palmer was so well at the end of a fortnight that her mother felt it no longer necessary to give up the whole of her time to her, and, contenting herself with visiting her once or twice a day, returned from that period to her own home and her own habits, in which she found the Miss Dashwoods very ready to resume their former share. About the third or fourth morning after their being thus resettled in Berkeley Street, Mrs. Jennings, on returning from her ordinary visit to Mrs. Palmer, entered the drawing-room where Eleanor was sitting by herself with an air of such hurrying importance as prepared her to hear something wonderful, and giving her time only to form that idea, began directly to justify it by saying, "Lord, my dear Miss Dashwood, have you heard the news?" "No, ma'am, what is it?" "Something so strange, but you shall hear it all. When I got to Mr. Palmer's, I found Charlotte quite in a fuss about the child. She was sure it was very ill. It cried and fretted and was all over pimples. So I looked at it directly, and, 'Lord, my dear,' says I, 'it is nothing in the world but the red gum,' and nurse said just the same. But Charlotte, she would not be satisfied, so Mr. Donovan was sent for, and luckily he happened to just come in from Harley Street. So he stepped over directly, and as soon as ever he saw the child, he said, just as we did, that it was nothing in the world but the red gum, and then Charlotte was easy. And so, just as he was going away again, it came into my head, and I am sure I do not know how I happened to think of it, but it came into my head to ask him if there was any news. So upon that he smirked and simpered and looked grave and seemed to know something or other, and at last he said in a whisper, 'For fear any unpleasant report should reach the young ladies under your care as to their sister's indisposition, I think it advisable to say that I believe there is no great reason for alarm. I hope Mrs. Dashwood will do very well.' 'What? Is Fanny ill?' 'That is exactly what I said, my dear. Lord, says I, is Mrs. Dashwood ill?' So then it all came out. And the long and the short of the matter, by all I can learn, seems to be this. Mr. Edward Ferrars, the very young man I used to joke with you about, but however, as it turns out, I am monstrous glad there was never anything in it. Mr. Edward Ferrars, it seems, has been engaged above this 12-month to my cousin Lucy. There's for you, my dear. And not a creature knowing a syllable of the matter except Nancy. Could you have believed such a thing possible? There is no great wonder in their liking one another, but that matters should be brought so forward between them and nobody suspected. That is strange. I never happened to see them together, or I'm sure I should have found it out directly. Well, and so this was kept a great secret for fear of Mrs. Ferrars, and neither she nor your brother or sister suspected a word of the matter. Till this very morning, poor Nancy, who, you know, is a well-meaning creature but no conjurer, popped it all out. 'Lord,' thinks she to herself, 'they are all so fond of Lucy, to be sure they will make no difficulty about it.' And so away she went to your sister, who was sitting all alone at her carpet-work, little suspecting what was to come, for she had just been saying to your brother only 5 minutes before that she thought to make a match between Edward and some lord's daughter or other, I forget who. So you may think what a blow it was to all her vanity and pride. She fell into violent hysterics immediately, with such screams as reached your brother's ears as he was sitting in his own dressing-room downstairs, thinking about writing a letter to his steward in the country. So up he flew directly, and a terrible scene took place, for Lucy was come to them by that time, little dreaming what was going on. Poor soul, I pity her. And I must say, I think she was used very hardly, for your sister scolded like any fury, and soon drove her into a fainting fit. Nancy, she fell upon her knees and cried bitterly, and your brother, he walked about the room and said he did not know what to do. Mrs. Dashwood declared they should not stay a minute longer in the house, and your brother was forced to go down upon his knees, too, to persuade her to let them stay till they had packed up their clothes. Then she fell into hysterics again, and he was so frightened that he would send for Mr. Donovan, and Mr. Donovan found the house in all this uproar. The carriage was at the door, ready to take my poor cousins away, and they were just stepping in as he came off. 'Poor Lucy is in such a condition,' he says, 'she could hardly walk. And Nancy, she was almost as bad. I declare I have no patience with your sister. and I hope with all my heart it will be a match in spite of her. Lord, what a taking poor Mr. Edward will be in when he hears of it. To have his love used so scornfully, for they say he is monstrous fond of her, as well he may. I should not wonder if he was to be in the greatest passion, and Mr. Donovan thinks just the same. He and I had a great deal of talk about it, and the best of all is that he has gone back again to Harley Street, that he may be within call when Mrs. Ferrers is told of it, for she was sent for as soon as ever my cousins left the house, for your sister was sure she would be in hysterics too. And so she may, for what I care. I have no pity for either of them. I have no notion of people's making such a to-do about money and greatness. There is no reason on earth why Mr. Edward and Lucy should not marry, for I am sure Mrs. Ferrers may afford to do very well by her son, and though Lucy has next to nothing herself, she knows better than anybody how to make the most of everything. I dare say if Mrs. Ferrers would only allow him 500 a year, she would make as good an appearance with it as anybody else would with 8. Lord, how snug they might live in such another cottage as yours, or a little bigger, with 2 maids and 2 men. And I believe I could help them to a housemaid, for my Betty has a sister out of place that would fit them exactly.
Here Mrs. Jennings ceased, and as Eleanor had had time enough to collect her thoughts, she was able to give such an answer and make such observations as the subject might naturally be supposed to produce. Happy to find that she was not suspected of any extraordinary interest in it, that Mrs. Jennings, as she had of late often hoped might be the case, had ceased to imagine her at all attached to Edward, and happy above all the rest, in the absence of Marianne, she felt very well able to speak of the affair without embarrassment, and to give her judgment, as she believed, with impartiality on the conduct of everyone concerned in it. She could hardly determine what her own expectation of its event really was, though she earnestly tried to drive away the notion of its being possible to end otherwise at last than in the marriage of Edward and Lucy. What Mrs. Ferrers would say and do, though there could not be a doubt of its nature, she was anxious to hear, and still more anxious to know how Edward would conduct himself. For him she felt much compassion, for Lucy very little, and it cost her some pains to procure that little. For the rest of the party, none at all. As Mrs. Jennings could talk on no other subject, Eleanor soon saw the necessity of preparing Marianne for its discussion. No time was to be lost in undeceiving her, in making her acquainted with the real truth, and endeavouring to bring her to hear it talked of by others without betraying that she felt any uneasiness for her sister or any resentment against Edward. Eleanor's office was a painful one. She was going to remove what she really believed to be her sister's chief consolation, to give such particulars of Edward as she feared would ruin him for ever in her good opinion, and to make Marianne, by a resemblance in their situations, which to her fancy would seem strong, feel all her own disappointment over again. But, unwelcome as such a task must be, it was necessary to be done, and Eleanor therefore hastened to perform it. She was very far from wishing to dwell on her own feelings, or to represent herself as suffering much, any otherwise than as the self-command she had practised since her first knowledge of Edward's engagement might suggest a hint of what was practicable to Marianne. Her narration was clear and simple, and though it could not be given without emotion, it was not accompanied by violent agitation nor impetuous grief. That belonged rather to the hearer, for Marianne listened with horror and cried excessively. Eleanor was to be the comforter of others in her own distresses, no less than in theirs, and all the comfort that could be given by assurances of her own composure of mind, and a very earnest vindication of Edward from every charge but of imprudence, was readily offered. But Marianne for some time would give credit to neither. Edward seemed a second Willoughby, and acknowledging, as Eleanor did, that she had loved him most sincerely, could she feel less than herself? As for Lucy Steele, she considered her so totally unamiable, so absolutely incapable of attaching a sensible man, that she could not be persuaded at first to believe, and afterwards to pardon, any former affection of Edward for her. She would not even admit it to have been natural, and Eleanor left her to be convinced that it was so, by that which only could convince her, a better knowledge of mankind. Her first communication had reached no further than to state the fact of the engagement and the length of time it had existed. Marianne's feelings had then broken in and put an end to all regularity of detail, and for some time all that could be done was to soothe her distress, lessen her alarms, and combat her resentment. The first question on her side, which led to further particulars, was, "How long has this been known to you, Eleanor? Has he written to you?" "I have known it these 4 months. When Lucy first came to Barton Park last November, she told me in confidence of her engagement." At these words, Marianne's eyes expressed the astonishment which her lips could not utter. After a pause of wonder, she exclaimed, "4 months? Have you known of this 4 months?" Eleanor confirmed it. "What, while attending me in all my misery, has this been on your heart? And I have reproached you for being happy. It was not fit that you should then know how much I was the reverse." 4 months, cried Marianne again. "So calm, so cheerful. How have you been supported?" "By feeling that I was doing my duty. My promise to Lucy obliged me to be secret. I owed it to her, therefore, to avoid giving any hint of the truth, and I owed it to my family and friends not to create in them a solicitude about me which it could not be in my power to satisfy." Marianne seemed much struck. "I have very often wished to undeceive yourself and my mother," added Eleanor, "and once or twice I have attempted it, but without betraying my trust, I never could have convinced you."
4 months, and yet you loved him."
"Yes, but I did not love only him, and while the comfort of others was dear to me, I was glad to spare them from knowing how much I felt. Now I can think and speak of it with little emotion. I would not have you suffer on my account, for I assure you I no longer suffer materially myself. I have many things to support me. I am not conscious of having provoked the disappointment by any imprudence of my own. I have borne it as much as possible without spreading it further. I acquit Edward of essential misconduct. I wish him very happy, and I am so sure of his always doing his duty that though now he may harbour some regret, in the end he must become so. Lucy does not want sense, and that is the foundation on which everything good may be built. And after all, Marianne, after all that is bewitching in the idea of a single and constant attachment, and all that can be said of one's happiness depending entirely on any particular person, it is not meant, it is not fit, it is not possible that it should be so. Edward will marry Lucy. He will marry a woman superior in person and understanding to half her sex, and time and habit will teach him to forget that he ever thought another superior to her.
"If such is your way of thinking," said Marianne, "if the loss of what is most valued is so easily to be made up by something else, your resolution, your self-command, are perhaps a little less to be wondered at. They are brought more within my comprehension."
"I understand you. You do not suppose that I have ever felt much. For 4 months, Marianne, I have had all this hanging on my mind, without being at liberty to speak of it to a single creature. Knowing that it would make you and my mother most unhappy whenever it were explained to you, yet unable to prepare you for it in the least, it was told me, it was in a manner forced on me by the very person herself, whose prior engagement ruined all my prospects, and told me, as I thought, with triumph. This person's suspicions, therefore, I have had to oppose by endeavouring to appear indifferent where I have been most deeply interested. And it has not been only once. I have had her hopes and exultation to listen to again and again. I have known myself to be divided from Edward forever, without hearing one circumstance that could make me less desire the connection. Nothing has proved him unworthy, nor has anything declared him indifferent to me. I have had to contend against the unkindness of his sister and the insolence of his mother, and have suffered the punishment of an attachment without enjoying its advantages. And all this has been going on at a time when, as you know too well, it has not been my only unhappiness. If you can think me capable of ever feeling, surely you may suppose that I have suffered now. The composure of mind with which I have brought myself at present to consider the matter, the consolation that I have been willing to admit, have been the effect of constant and painful exertion. They did not spring up of themselves. They did not occur to relieve my spirits at first.
No, Marianne. Then, if I had not been bound to silence, perhaps nothing could have kept me entirely, not even what I owed to my dearest friends, from openly showing that I was very unhappy.
Marianne was quite subdued.
Oh, Eleanor, she cried, you have made me hate myself forever. How barbarous have I been to you! You who have been my only comfort, who have borne with me in all my misery, who have seemed to be only suffering for me, is this my gratitude? Is this the only return I can make you? Because your merit cries out upon myself, I have been trying to do it away.
The tenderest caresses followed this confession. In such a frame of mind as she was now in, Eleanor had no difficulty in obtaining from her whatever promise she required, and at her request, Marianne engaged never to speak of the affair to anyone with the least appearance of bitterness, to meet Lucy without betraying the smallest increase of dislike to her, and even to see Edward himself, if chance should bring them together, without any diminution of her usual cordiality. These were great concessions, but where Marianne felt that she had injured, no reparation could be too much for her to make. She performed her promise of being discreet to admiration. She attended to all that Mrs. Jennings had to say upon the subject with an unchanging complexion, dissented from her in nothing, and was heard 3 times to say, "Yes, ma'am." She listened to her praise of Lucy with only moving from one chair to another, and when Mrs. Jennings talked of Edward's affection, it cost her only a spasm in her throat. Such advances towards heroism in her sister made Eleanor feel equal to anything herself. The next morning brought a further trial of it, in a visit from their brother, who came with a most serious aspect to talk over the dreadful affair and bring them news of his wife. "You have heard, I suppose," said he with great solemnity as soon as he was seated, "of the very shocking discovery that took place under our roof yesterday." They all looked their assent. It seemed too awful a moment for speech. "Your sister," he continued, "has suffered dreadfully. Mrs. Ferrars, too. In short, it has been a scene of such complicated distress, but I hope that the storm may be weathered without our being any of us quite overcome. Poor Fanny, she was in hysterics all yesterday, but I would not alarm you too much. Donovan says there is nothing materially to be apprehended. Her constitution is a good one, and her resolution equal to anything. She has borne it all with the fortitude of an angel. She says she shall never think well of anybody again, and one cannot wonder at it after being so deceived. Meeting with such ingratitude where so much kindness had been shown, so much confidence had been placed. It was quite out of the benevolence of her heart that she had asked these young women to her house, merely because she thought they deserved some attention, were harmless, well-behaved girls, and would be pleasant companions. For otherwise, we both wished very much to have invited you and Marianne to be with us while your kind friend there was attending her daughter. And now to be so rewarded. I wish with all my heart," says poor Fanny in her affectionate way, "that we had asked your sisters instead of them." Here he stopped to be thanked, which being done, he went on, "What poor Mrs. Ferrars suffered when first Fanny broke it to her is not to be described. While she, with the truest affection, had been planning a most eligible connection for him, was it to be supposed that he could be all the time secretly engaged to another person? Such a suspicion could never have entered her head. If she suspected any prepossession elsewhere, it could not be in that quarter. There, to be sure," said she, "I might have thought myself safe." She was quite in agony. We consulted together, however, as to what should be done, and at last she determined to send for Edward. He came, but I am sorry to relate what ensued. All that Mrs. Ferrars could say to make him put an end to the engagement, assisted too, as you may well suppose, by my arguments and Fanny's entreaties, was of no avail. Duty, affection, everything was disregarded. I never thought Edward so stubborn, so unfeeling before. His mother explained to him her liberal designs in case of his marrying Miss Morton, told him she would settle on him the Norfolk estate, which clear of land tax brings in a good 1,000 a year, offered even, when matters grew desperate, to make it 1,200. And in opposition to this, if he still persisted in this low connection, represented to him the certain penury that must attend the match.
His own £2,000, she protested, should be his all. She would never see him again, and so far would she be from affording him the smallest assistance that if he were to enter into any profession with a view of better support, she would do all in her power to prevent him advancing in it. Here, Marianne, in an ecstasy of indignation, clapped her hands together and cried, "Gracious God, can this be possible?" "Well, may you wonder, Marianne," replied her brother, "at the obstinacy which could resist such arguments as these. Your exclamation is very natural." Marianne was going to retort, but she remembered her promises and forbore. "All this, however," he continued, "was urged in vain. Edward said very little, but what he did say was in the most determined manner. Nothing should prevail on him to give up his engagement. He would stand to it, cost him what it might." "Then," cried Mrs. Jennings, with blunt sincerity, no longer able to be silent, "he has acted like an honest man. I beg your pardon, Mr. Dashwood, but if he had done otherwise, I should have thought him a rascal. I have some little concern in the business as well as yourself, for Lucy Steele is my cousin, and I believe there is not a better kind of girl in the world, nor one who more deserves a good husband." John Dashwood was greatly astonished, but his nature was calm, not open to provocation, and he never wished to offend anybody, especially anybody of good fortune. He therefore replied, without any resentment, "I would by no means speak disrespectfully of any relation of yours, madam. Miss Lucy Steele is, I dare say, a very deserving young woman, but in the present case, you know, the connection must be impossible. And to have entered into a secret engagement with a young man under her uncle's care, the son of a woman, especially of such very large fortune as Mrs. Ferrers, is perhaps altogether a little extraordinary. In short, I do not mean to reflect upon the behaviour of any person whom you have a regard for, Mrs. Jennings. We all wish her extremely happy, and Mrs. Ferrers's conduct through the whole has been such as every conscientious good mother in like circumstances would adopt. It has been dignified and liberal. Edward has drawn his own lot, and I fear it will be a bad one." Marianne sighed out her similar apprehension, and Eleanor's heart wrung for the feelings of Edward, while braving his mother's threats for a woman who could not reward him.
"Well, sir," said Mrs. Jennings, "then how did it end?"
"I am sorry to say, ma'am, in a most unhappy rupture. Edward is dismissed forever from his mother's notice. He left her house yesterday, but where he is gone, or whether he is still in town, I do not know, for we, of course, can make no inquiry."
"Poor young man! And what is to become of him?"
"What indeed, ma'am? It is a melancholy consideration. Born to the prospect of such affluence, I cannot conceive a situation more deplorable. The interest of £2,000, how can a man live on it? And when to that is added the recollection that he might, but for his own folly, within 3 months have been in the receipt of £2,500 a year, for Miss Morton has £30,000, I cannot picture to myself a more wretched condition. We must all feel for him, and the more so because it is totally out of our power to assist him."
"Poor young man," cried Mrs. Jennings. "I am sure he should be very welcome to bed and board at my house, and so I would tell him if I could see him. It is not fit that he should be living about at his own charge now, at lodgings and taverns."
Eleanor's heart thanked her for such kindness towards Edward, though she could not forbear smiling at the form of it. "If he would only have done as well by himself," said John Dashwood, "as all his friends were disposed to do by him, he might now have been in his proper situation and would have wanted for nothing. But as it is, it must be out of anybody's power to assist him. And there is one thing more preparing against him, which must be worse than all. His mother has determined, with a very natural kind of spirit, to settle that estate upon Robert immediately, which might have been Edward's on proper conditions. I left her this morning with her lawyer, talking over the business."
"Well," said Mrs. Jennings, "that is her revenge. Everybody has a way of their own, but I don't think mine would be to make one son independent because another has plagued me."
Marianne got up and walked about the room.
"Can anything be more galling to the spirit of a man," continued John, "than to see his younger brother in possession of an estate which might have been his own? Poor Edward! I feel for him sincerely."
A few minutes more spent in the same kind of effusion concluded his visit,
and with repeated assurances to his sisters that he really believed there was no material danger in Fanny's indisposition, and that they need not therefore be very uneasy about it, he went away, leaving the three ladies unanimous in their sentiments on the present occasion, as far at least as it regarded Mrs. Ferrars's conduct, the Dashwoods, and Edwards. Marianne's indignation burst forth as soon as he quitted the room, and as her vehemence made reserve impossible in Eleanor and unnecessary in Mrs. Jennings, they all joined in a very spirited critique upon the party. Chapter 38. Mrs. Jennings was very warm in her praise of Edward's conduct, but only Eleanor and Marianne understood its true merit. They only knew how little he had had to tempt him to be disobedient, and how small was the consolation, beyond the consciousness of doing right, that could remain to him in the loss of friends and fortune. Eleanor gloried in his integrity, and Marianne forgave all his offences in compassion for his punishment. But though confidence between them was, by this public discovery, restored to its proper state, it was not a subject on which either of them were fond of dwelling when alone. Eleanor avoided it upon principle, as tending to fix still more upon her thoughts by the too warm, too positive assurances of Marianne, that belief of Edward's continued affection for herself which she rather wished to do away, and Marianne's courage soon failed her in trying to converse upon a topic which always left her more dissatisfied with herself than ever, by the comparison it necessarily produced between Eleanor's conduct and her own. She felt all the force of that comparison, but not, as her sister had hoped, to urge her to exertion now. She felt it with all the pain of continual self-reproach, regretted most bitterly that she had never exerted herself before, but it brought only the torture of penitence, without the hope of amendment. Her mind was so much weakened that she still fancied present exertion impossible, and therefore it only dispirited her more. Nothing new was heard by them for a day or two afterwards of affairs in Harley Street or Bartlett's Buildings. But though so much of the matter was known to them already that Mrs. Jennings might have had enough to do in spreading that knowledge further without seeking after more, she had resolved from the first to pay a visit of comfort and inquiry to her cousins as soon as she could, and nothing but the hindrance of more visitors than usual had prevented her going to them within that time. The third day succeeding their knowledge of the particulars was so fine, so beautiful a Sunday, as to draw many to Kensington Gardens, though it was only the second week in March. Mrs. Jennings and Eleanor were of the number, but Marianne, who knew that the Willoughbys were again in town, and had a constant dread of meeting them, chose rather to stay at home than venture into so public a place. An intimate acquaintance of Mrs. Jennings joined them soon after they entered the gardens, and Eleanor was not sorry that by her continuing with them and engaging all Mrs. Jennings's conversation, she was herself left to quiet reflection. She saw nothing of the Willoughbys, nothing of Edward, and for some time nothing of anybody who could by any chance, whether grave or gay, be interesting to her. But at last she found herself, with some surprise, accosted by Miss Steele, who, though looking rather shy, expressed great satisfaction in meeting them, and on receiving encouragement from the particular kindness of Mrs. Jennings, left her own party for a short time to join theirs. Mrs. Jennings immediately whispered to Eleanor, "Get it all out of her, my dear. She will tell you anything if you ask. You see, I cannot leave Mrs. Clark." It was lucky, however, for Mrs. Jennings's curiosity, and Eleanor's too, that she would tell anything without being asked, for nothing would otherwise have been learnt. "I am so glad to meet you," said Miss Steele, taking her familiarly by the arm, "for I wanted to see you of all things in the world." And then, lowering her voice, "I suppose Mrs. Jennings has heard all about it. Is she angry?" "Not at all, I believe, with you." "That is a good thing. And Lady Middleton, is she angry?" "I cannot suppose it possible that she should." "I am monstrous glad of it. Good gracious, I have had such a time of it. I never saw Lucy in such a rage in my life. She vowed at first she would never trim me up a new bonnet nor do anything else for me again so long as she lived. But now she has quite come to, and we are as good friends as ever. Look, she made me this bow to my hat and put in the feather last night. There now,
You are going to laugh at me too. But why should I not wear pink ribbons? I do not care if it is the doctor's favourite colour. I am sure, for my part, I should never have known he did like it better than any other colour if he had not happened to say so. My cousins have been so plaguing me, I declare sometimes I do not know which way to look before them. She had wandered away to a subject on which Eleanor had nothing to say, and therefore soon judged it expedient to find her way back again to the first. "Well, but Miss Dashwood," speaking triumphantly, "people may say what they choose about Mr. Ferrars declaring he would not have Lucy, for it is no such thing, I can tell you, and it is quite a shame for such ill-natured reports to be spread abroad. Whatever Lucy might think about it herself, you know, it was no business of other people to set it down for certain." "I never had anything of the kind hinted at before, I assure you," said Eleanor. "Oh, did not you? But it was said, I know, very well, and by more than one, for Miss Godby told Miss Sparks that nobody in their senses could expect Mr. Ferrars to give up a woman like Miss Morton with £30,000 to her fortune for Lucy Steele that had nothing at all. And I had it from Miss Sparks myself. And besides that, my cousin Richard said himself that when it came to the point, he was afraid Mr. Ferrars would be off. And when Edward did not come near us for 3 days, I could not tell what to think myself. And I believe in my heart Lucy gave it up all for lost. For we came away from your brother's Wednesday, and we saw nothing of him, not all Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and did not know what was become of him. Once Lucy thought to write to him, but then her spirits rose against that. However, this morning he came just as we came home from church, and then it all came out. How he had been sent for Wednesday to Harley Street, and been talked to by his mother and all of them, and how he had declared before them all that he loved nobody but Lucy, and nobody but Lucy would he have. And how he had been so worried by what had passed, that as soon as he had went away from his mother's house, he had got upon his horse and rid into the country somewhere or other, and how he had stayed about at an inn all Thursday and Friday on purpose to get the better of it. And after thinking it all over and over again, he said, it seemed to him as if now he had no fortune and no nothing at all, it would be quite unkind to keep her on to the engagement, because it must be for her loss, for he had nothing but £2,000 and no hope of anything else. And if he was to go into orders, as he had some thoughts, he could get nothing but a curacy, and how was they to live upon that? He could not bear to think of her doing no better, and so he begged, if she had the least mind for it, to put an end to the matter directly, and leave him shift for himself. I heard him say all this plain as could possibly be, and it was entirely for her sake and upon her account that he said a word about being off, and not upon his own. I will take my oath he never dropped a syllable of being tired of her, or of wishing to marry Miss Morton, or anything like it. But to be sure, Lucy would not give ear to such kind of talking, so she told him directly, with a great deal about sweet and love, you know, and all that. Oh, la, one can't repeat such kind of things, you know. She told him directly she had not the least mind in the world to be off, for she could live with him upon a trifle, and how little soever he might have, she should be very glad to have it all, you know, or something of the kind. So then he was monstrous happy, and talked on some time about what they should do, and they agreed he should take orders directly, and they must wait to be married till he got a living. And just then I could not hear any more, for my cousin called from below to tell me Mrs. Richardson was come in her coach, and would take one of us to Kensington Gardens, so I was forced to go into the room and interrupt them to ask Lucy if she would like to go, but she did not care to leave Edward, so I just run upstairs and put on a pair of silk stockings and came off with the Richardsons.
I do not understand what you mean by interrupting them, said Eleanor. You were all in the same room together, were not you?
No, indeed, not us. La, Miss Dashwood, you do not think people make love when anybody else is by. Oh, for shame! To be sure, you must know better than that, laughing affectedly. No, no, they were shut up in the drawing-room together, and all I heard was only by listening at the door.
How, cried Eleanor, have you been repeating to me what you only learnt yourself by listening at the door? I am sorry I did not know it before, for I certainly would not have suffered you to give me particulars of a conversation which you ought not to have known yourself. How could you behave so unfairly by your sister?
Oh, la, there is nothing in that. I only stood at the door and heard what I could, and I am sure Lucy would have done just the same by me,
for a year or two back, when Martha Sharp and I had so many secrets together, she never made any bones of hiding in a closet or behind a chimney board, on purpose to hear what we said. Eleanor tried to talk of something else, but Miss Steele could not be kept beyond a couple of minutes from what was uppermost in her mind. "Edward talks of going to Oxford soon," said she, "but now he is lodging at Number Something Pall Mall. What an ill-natured woman his mother is, isn't she? And your brother and sister were not very kind. However, I shan't say anything against them to you, and to be sure they did send us home in their own chariot, which was more than I looked for. And for my part, I was all in a fright for fear your sister should ask us for the huzzifs she had gave us a day or two before. But however, nothing was said about them, and I took care to keep mine out of sight. Edward have got some business at Oxford, he says, so he must go there for a time, and after that, as soon as he can light upon a bishop, he will be ordained. I wonder what curacy he will get. Good gracious," giggling as she spoke, "I'd lay my life I know what my cousins will say when they hear of it. They will tell me I should write to the doctor to get Edward the curacy of his new living. I know they will, but I am sure I would not do such a thing for all the world. La, I shall say directly, I wonder how you could think of such a thing. I write to the doctor, indeed." "Well," said Eleanor, "it is a comfort to be prepared against the worst. You have got your answer ready." Miss Steele was going to reply on the same subject, but the approach of her own party made another more necessary. "Oh, la, here come the Richardsons. I had a vast deal more to say to you, but I must not stay away from them, not any longer. I assure you they are very genteel people. He makes a monstrous deal of money, and they keep their own coach. I have not time to speak to Mrs. Jennings about it myself, but pray tell her I am quite happy to hear she is not in anger against us, and Lady Middleton the same. And if anything should happen to take you and your sister away, and Mrs. Jennings should want company, I am sure we should be very glad to come and stay with her for as long a time as she likes. I suppose Lady Middleton won't ask us any more this bout. Goodbye. I am sorry Miss Marianne was not here. Remember me kindly to her. La, if you have not got your spotted muslin on, I wonder you was not afraid of it being torn." Such was her parting concern, for after this she had time only to pay her farewell compliments to Mrs. Jennings, before her company was claimed by Mrs. Richardson, and Eleanor was left in possession of knowledge which might feed her powers of reflection some time, though she had learnt very little more than what had been already foreseen and foreplanned in her own mind. Edward's marriage with Lucy was as firmly determined on, and the time of its taking place remained as absolutely uncertain as she had concluded it would be. Everything depended, exactly after her expectation, on his getting that preferment, of which, at present, there seemed not the smallest chance. As soon as they returned to the carriage, Mrs. Jennings was eager for information, but as Eleanor wished to spread as little as possible intelligence that had in the first place been so unfairly obtained, she confined herself to the brief repetition of such simple particulars as she felt assured that Lucy, for the sake of her own consequence, would choose to have known. The continuance of their engagement and the means that were able to be taken for promoting its end was all her communication, and this produced from Mrs. Jennings the following natural remark.
"Wait for his having a living! Aye, we all know how that will end. They will wait a twelvemonth, and finding no good comes of it, will set down upon a curacy of £50 a year, with the interest of his £2,000 and what little matter Mr. Steele and Mr. Pratt can give her. Then they will have a child every year, and Lord help 'em how poor they will be. I must see what I can give them towards furnishing their house. Two maids and two men, indeed, as I talked the other day. No, no, they must get a stout girl of all works. Betty's sister would never do for them now."
The next morning brought Eleanor a letter by the twopenny post from Lucy herself. It was as follows.
"Bartlett's Building, March. I hope my dear Miss Dashwood will excuse the liberty I take of writing to her, but I know your friendship for me will make you pleased to hear such a good account of myself and my dear Edward, after all the troubles we have went through lately, therefore will make no more apologies, but proceed to say that, thank God, though we have suffered dreadfully, we are both quite well now, and as happy as we must always be in one another's love. We have had great trials and great persecutions, but, however, at the same time, gratefully acknowledge many friends, yourself not the least among them, whose great kindness I shall always thankfully remember, as will Edward too, who I have told of it. I am sure you will be glad to hear, as likewise, dear Mrs. Jennings. I spent 2 happy hours with him yesterday afternoon. He would not hear of our parting, though earnestly did I, as I thought my duty required, urge him to it for prudence sake, and would have parted for ever on the spot, would he consent to it. But he said it should never be. He did not regard his mother's anger while he could have my affections. Our prospects are not very bright, to be sure, but we must wait and hope for the best. He will be ordained shortly, and should it ever be in your power to recommend him to anybody that has a living to bestow, I'm very sure you will not forget us. And dear Mrs. Jennings, too, trust she will speak a good word of us to Sir John or Mr. Palmer or any friend that might be able to assist us. Poor Anne was much to blame for what she did, but she did it for the best, so I say nothing. Hope Mrs. Jennings won't think it too much trouble to give us a call, should she come this way any morning. 'Twould be a great kindness, and my cousins would be proud to know her. My paper reminds me to conclude, and begging to be most gratefully and respectfully remembered to her, and to Sir John, and Lady Middleton, and the dear children when you chance to see them, and love to Miss Marianne, I am, etc. As soon as Eleanor had finished it, she performed what she concluded to be its writer's real design by placing it in the hands of Mrs. Jennings, who read it aloud with many comments of satisfaction and praise. "Very well indeed. How prettily she writes. Aye, that was quite proper to let him be off if he would. That was just like Lucy. Poor soul. I wish I could get him a living with all my heart. She calls me dear Mrs. Jennings, you see. She is a good-hearted girl as ever lived. Very well, upon my word. That sentence is very prettily turned. Yes, yes, I will go and see her, sure enough. How attentive she is to think of everybody. Thank you, my dear, for showing it me. It is as pretty a letter as ever I saw, and does Lucy's head and heart great credit."